This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello, welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. Today I'm interviewing Dr. Bavita Patale, Associate Professor based across the Centre for Longitudinal Studies at the Institute of Social Research and the MRC Unit for Lifelong Health and Ageing at Faculty of Population Health Sciences at UCL. Bavita uses large population-based data sets to investigate mental health through the life course and also works on evaluations of school-based intervention programs. If you're a fan of our In Conversation series, please subscribe on iTunes or your preferred streaming platform. Let us know how we did with the rating or review and do share with friends and colleagues. Bavita, thank you for joining me. Can you start with an introduction?
Yes. Hi, Jo. So my research interests primarily fall in the areas of developmental science and epidemiology with the focus on mental health. So my research focuses on mental health through the life course, health inequalities, and increasingly or more recently, the intersection between physical and mental health, or more broadly, as I'd like to just think of it as health. I am interested in how we can achieve better health and well-being through our lives and the universal interventions and structural changes that we might need. Or in other words, how do we better design our societies to achieve better health and well-being?
And what's your background? What brought you into this field of work?
This is a tough one, and I think lots of things come together here. So my first degree was a triple major that included psychology and political science, which I know is probably unusual, but this I studied in India. And I studied after that developmental and social psychology for my master's. So I've always thought studying developmental psychology is really important in the context of social psychology. So I wanted a master's program that did both. If I did not become a researcher, I think I'd have been a school teacher. I'm inherently interested in children's development and in schools as a context that is important for children. And I think all of these things come together in my research. And now I am based across two faculties in two very multidisciplinary departments at UCL. So I have a cross-faculty post. So I work with economists, sociologists, anthropologists, demographers, but also on the other hand with psychiatrists, medics, and clinical scientists. And I think this really multidisciplinary perspective is really valuable and informs a lot of the way I do research.
Bavita, you use large national studies, including the British birth cohorts, to investigate mental health through the life course. What key areas have arisen from this work, particularly in relation to mental health and young people in the UK?
Yes, so as you said, I use lots of British birth cohort studies, but primarily I use the youngest of the British birth cohorts, which is called the Millennium Cohort Study, which is a cohort of over 19,000 babies born at the turn of the century. I think lots of interesting findings related to mental health have come from investigating this cohort because it's really valuable, large population-based study with mental health data right from childhood onwards. Some work that we did looked at, for example, mental ill health and mental well-being and how these are not necessarily the same thing and that they often have different correlates. And because it's such a rich multidisciplinary study, we were able to look at a wide range of things that are associated with mental ill health and well-being. So from individual characteristics, but family environment, parental factors, but also the school environment, friends, and even wider. So neighborhood environment, perceived neighborhood safety, and urban-rural context, and so on. So this really sort of rich data set that is so multidisciplinary allows us to look at the varying factors that influence children's mental health. And I think this particular research highlighted how important children's well-being is as well, and how often well-being is forgotten in the research on mental health, when most mental health research is really research about mental health disorders. And I think we often forget that children's well-being is a part of their mental health.
You said that sometimes people fail to see the difference between mental ill health and mental well-being. Can you define the difference, specify it?
I know we don't like drawing analogies with physical health, but one way to think about it is that you could have a chronic physical health condition like type 1 diabetes or asthma, but still be very, very physically healthy and even be a competitive athlete, for example. And I don't see why mental health shouldn't be at least considered in the same way. I mean, we recognize that at severe levels of difficulties, well-being is very difficult. But well-being is about finding meaning in life, purpose, like feeling like you're doing the things you want to be doing and not being held back by your mental health difficulties. So I think it is genuinely possible for children to occasionally, you know, sometimes experience anxiety, sometimes experience mental health difficulties, but still live a life where they find meaning and purpose and achieve the things they would like to achieve or are able to try the things they want to try and so on. So I think that's where the distinction between well-being and good mental health.
You talked about, I mean, all that kind of rich area, rich data that you're using. Are there any particular key aspects of it that you want to highlight?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really nice point. So I think the key thing to highlight really is that these data sets are available for all researchers to use. We share them through the UK Data Service. And all you really have to do is, if you're a researcher, is, you know, agree to obviously all the data protection and all of these aspects of it. But then you can use the data set. It costs no money. It doesn't, you know, there's no barriers to access. So not only are they data that no individual researcher could ever collect on their own, I mean, the scale of them and the expense, but importantly, they're available to the entire research community to use. And we did some work looking at who uses Millennium Course study data, and psychologists don't use the data set very much at all compared to lots of other disciplines. So I think just want to flag that these data are there. They're amazing.
Your recent research has highlighted the increasing levels of mental health difficulties faced by the current generation of young people in the UK. Can you quantify this for us? What does this increase look like?
Yes. So in our research, we have mainly compared quite recent generations of young people in the Millennium Cohort study. So they will be around 19 years old now. But at the last data that we analyzed closely was when they were 14, 15, around 2015. And we compared this to adolescents born 10 years previously, so in around 1990-1991. And what we see is that there's lots of changes in mental health and health-related behaviors. And this is something that lots of other data sets corroborate. So we know from evidence, not just in the UK, but across other mainly rich industrialized nations, that mental health difficulties are increasing in young people. But at the same time, we also see that other things are also changing, but not necessarily for the worse. So, for example, a key thing for us has been understanding changes, but understanding changes across different health outcomes for young people. So where prevalence of internalizing mental health is increasing and prevalence of things like self-harming behavior, other things are not increasing or decreasing even, like antisocial behaviors and substance use. So less young people smoke and drink alcohol and also start at older ages than was the case in prior generations. This leads to really interesting questions around how changing social norms around smoking and drinking, for example, affect the associations between these things. Because we know substance use and mental health are related, for example, but as their prevalences change in opposite directions, that leads to the question of, are the associations also changing over time? And what we find in more recent work that we've done is that although smoking is decreasing, it seems to be decreasing at a faster rate in young people without mental health problems. So in other words, mental health difficulties and smoking are more likely to co-occur now than they used to co-occur. Find similar associations with BMI. So although higher BMIs are becoming more common in this cohort, so that's another parallel trend over the last few decades, is that BMI is increasing in every generation compared to the generation before. But we find that higher BMIs and more mental health problems are now more likely to co-occur than it used to be the case. So although higher BMIs are becoming more widespread. And you might argue that you might find the opposite. So as more young people have higher BMIs, the association of mental health might not be as strong, but actually we find the opposite, which is as. So yeah, so I think there's some really interesting implications from these generational differences in not only how any one thing changes, so for whether it's substance use or mental health difficulties, but also how these changes reflect their changing association. And I think there's really important implications of this also for public health interventions and how they're planned, because lots of the data we use in terms of what we think is important or how we approach public health interventions or public health messaging is based on evidence from prior decades. Right. Because that's how evidence works in science, right? We build evidence based on the eventually influence policy. But then by the time the influence policy, sometimes it might be the case that actually the associations we see or what the policy is based on may no longer be the case.
That there has been a large increase in certain types of mental health difficulties, those internalized mood disorders such as depression, and also an increase in self-harming behavior. And I wonder what you think it is that's going on in contemporary society that accounts for this.
This is the million-dollar question, to be honest with you. I suspect it's many things coming together, so I really, really doubt it will be one thing that explains the increases we see in mental health difficulties. It's important to flag that it's not something we only see in young people. So this sort of increase in psychological distress, broadly speaking, is something we observe across all age groups, which makes sense because today's young people are tomorrow's parents. So I think we can expect to see the repercussions of the increases we're seeing now in future years as well. I guess the other thing to flag is that these increases in mental ill health come at a time when we live longer than ever before and are better off than ever as a society. So I think there's some interesting thing to unpack there about what it is about the way we design society that is leading to increased levels of distress. And so I am increasingly interested and thinking about the questions around how we structure our societies and what we value as a society and the role of this in our mental health. And I think there's lots of interesting writing and reading out there just to highlight one thing. So the focus on GDP as something we have used to guide policy for many decades, and how this does not seem to improve our well-being or mental health, and doesn't seem to improve the well-being of either, as in the sense of, you know, lots of implications of constant focus on GDP growth, on climate change and things as well. So I think a future where we put human well-being at the heart of decision-making and policy seems like it needs to be an inevitable next step if we are to avoid the increasing levels of distress we're seeing now. Important to flag again that although I completely agree with the notion that our biology and our genes are very important at determining risk or susceptibility to greater mental health difficulties, that the rapid increases we're seeing generation on generation are unlikely to be due to fundamental ways in which our genes or biology have changed, because we don't evolve that quickly, if that makes sense. Really important to think about wider societal, structural, environmental things that might be at play and how they might be at play together. So all of these things also don't happen in isolation. So lots of things are probably coming together, but also interacting in interesting ways with each other.
I want to turn now to how you translate some of this research into clinical practice and into community-based interventions. Can you tell me about your work evaluating school-based intervention programs?
Yes, so most of the school-based intervention programs I'm involved in, I support this work rather than lead it, but most of it is related to thinking about earlier intervention and prevention. So again, most of the way we deal with mental ill health is reactive. So we wait for children, young people, adults to really struggle. And then when people meet a certain threshold for really struggling, they receive mental health services. And it's very hard in a system that has very little capacity at the moment to support everybody with difficulty. So it has become the case that you have to really be struggling. And there's often long waiting lists and so on. So I think it's really important to think about earlier intervention and prevention, because it's mental health difficulties have such a large cost, both to individuals, but also to society at large. And when we wait for difficulties to get really serious before we try to help individuals, we've sort of lost the opportunity to have possibly helped when things were less dire and prevented them from getting so bad. So I think in this context, especially for young people, schools are really important because most young people go to school. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, they're simultaneously have sort of this universal aspect of being able to access most young people there, but also this destigmatizing aspect as well, because if you do universal stuff in schools, it is for everyone. So it sort of removes the stigma that can be sometimes associated with mental health difficulties. Thinking of a paper that got published a couple of weeks ago, we looked at data from over 600 primary schools. So this is survey data from around 25,000 young people in primary schools that is linked to school administrative data, so school survey data, and also to the National Pupil Database. And then to look at how mental health varies across schools. So we know, for example, for educational attainment, a substantial proportion of attainment is explained by the school level. So, you know, so 20% of children's education attainment, that variance is explained by clustering within schools. And similarly, we wanted to look at this for mental health, and we find a substantial between school variation and mental health, so around 5%. And what we found really interesting is we looked from the school census data, we looked at characteristics of the school. So things like the school size, but also the proportion of children in the school that come from a more socioeconomically disadvantaged families, the proportion of girls and boys, proportion of ethnic minorities. And we also looked at school climate. So school climate being more around things like children feeling like they have an adult they can trust in their school, children feeling like their school is a safe space. And what we find is the school composition factors don't really explain much of the school variation in mental health. But the school climate explains around a third to a half of the between school differences we see in mental health. So enormous effect. It suggests that I know lots of the school-based interventions tend to be very manualized approaches, right? So you have a manualized intervention with a name, often involving payment to the developers and so on. And this is what we normally evaluate. And this might be the way, but equally, I have the sense that what our findings show is that schools in which children feel safe and can trust an adult in their school are better environments for children's mental health than schools where this is not the case. And this is not a surprise. I mean, it intuitively makes sense, but equally, it's really interesting how much it matters. And not only are schools with better environments better for children's mental health, but we know from lots of other research that the better environments for learning and, you know, attainment and other educational outcomes that the government and Ofsted and things tend to care about more than mental health as well. These findings made us think about the importance of sort of structured named interventions. I think there is sort of scope for this, and we have to carry on doing the research we do to evaluate them robustly. But equally, I think there is scope for valuing schools being good at what they do and encouraging a nurturing and safe climate for children. And I think it's really important also to flag here that schools have a lot going on. And so there's an increased government focus on schools as a context for children's mental health. And I think that is important, but equally it comes at a time where schools are not getting more funding or more resources to be able to do this. We did a study across 10 European countries to try and work out what schools do. What provision do schools have? What support do they have? What they think about providing mental health support to the children in their schools? And also asked around the barriers and facilitators. So what they find are the biggest barriers to be able to providing the support they want to. By and large, it's not things that people think it will be. So people think, oh yeah, it's around stigma and things. But no, schools care about their children's mental health. And the biggest barriers are teacher capacity, resources, funding. So it's not that schools don't want to do more. It's just they also need resources and support to be able to do more.
Professor, I'm going to turn to something else now. You recently co-authored a paper in the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry, the JCPP, giving your perspective on plans to standardise mental health measurement. Under these plans, obtaining funding for research related to depression and anxiety will be conditional on using specific scales. Can you summarise your concerns about this move?
Yeah. So for listeners who might not be aware of the background, essentially a few months ago, the Wellcome Trust in the UK and the National Institutes of Mental Health in the US, NIMH, which together are probably some of the biggest funders of mental health research worldwide, announced that mental health research related to depression and anxiety will be sort of conditional on using 4 specific scales that they laid out, that one that measures depression, one that measures anxiety, one that measures depression and anxiety in children, and sort of one well-being measure. I think there are several issues with this, and we outlined this really well in the paper, but I think the implications are for both the quality and robustness of mental health science, but also for the scope of what we consider when we study mental ill health. So, for example, if you limit research on depression to these 9 symptoms of depression, you potentially lose out on lots of insights that are important to various aspects related to depression. So I think there's sort of alongside questions around, is it a good idea for funding to be conditional on how you measure depression? I think there's also real concerns around how this might narrow what we learn about mental health in the next few decades if this actually comes into force. With young people's mental health, for me, there's also this frustration that while the forest burns around us, we seem to be discussing imperfect ways of measuring the flames. And this is a terrible analogy, I realize. And I totally believe measurement is really important. But whichever way you measure it, the evidence clearly indicates that difficulties are worsening for young people. And I do not see how only measuring things in one very specific way will help us fix it. Because when we narrow the scope of inquiry, we massively risk also narrowing the scope of the solutions we come up with. More recently and more broadly thinking about the role of funders, and this is not in the paper, but this is just something that I've been thinking of for the last couple of weeks. I understand the need or the role of funders in improving scientific conduct and ethics in research and bias and inequality in how research funding is allocated. But you know how in journal articles, sometimes you see the statement that where you declare that the funders had no role in the conducting and reporting of this research. And this sort of disconnect between funders' role as funders and their role in how the science is actually conducted, I think has been important for science. And with this move, we essentially won't be able to declare this anymore. So we won't be able to honestly say on a paper that the funders had no role in the conducting and reporting of this research because they pre-decided for us exactly the 9 items we had to use to measure depression, at the exclusion of things that might have actually been more valuable or relevant or useful for that particular study. So I am also uncertain about whether this is a good development in terms of funders' roles in the scientific process.
With this mandate, I mean, what action, if any, would you like to see to mitigate the consequences of this?
We outlined some recommendations in the paper around slowing down the rollout, considering, how it's going, and maybe also reconsidering the implications of this mandate and how it might affect the quality of mental health science in future. I think there's probably important considerations around also how mental health is measured in different cultures and different societies. So, for example, we recently did a project looking at adolescent mental health in India and, you know, with young people, and we spoke to stakeholders and experts locally, and things that they felt were important to capture and the words that were used to capture it in the questionnaire was sort of different from the measures we might use here in the UK with young people in schools. So I think if you say you have to use XYZ items from X measure, you also sort of risk forcing one certain conceptualization, which is fairly Western, on the rest of the world. And I don't think we've done enough research across contexts and cultures with these measures yet to know whether that's a valid or appropriate thing to do.
What other research areas are coming up for you? And is there anything else in the pipeline that you'd like to mention?
So we spoke about the research that we're doing increasingly around how things are changing around time. And I think with similar to time, there's also this question around place. So I think most mental health research, as I just alluded to, tends to come from a small group of mainly rich industrialized countries. And this has implications for how we understand mental health, but how we also treat and think about supporting young people. And some interventions might be universally sort of suitable, but some might be very context specific. So I'm increasingly interested in understanding things in multiple contexts or settings. And so most recently, we've done something really simple. So let's take something we think is very simple. So the gender gap in adolescent mental health. So with colleagues, we looked at data from over 70 countries. So this is nationally representative data from over 70 countries of more than 500,000 adolescents who've completed sort of simple measures of psychological distress and well-being. And when you look at the gender gap across these 70 countries, you see enormous heterogeneity. So we sort of think we know there's a gender gap and that teenage girls are likely to have worse mental health than boys. And this is true in most countries, but that the extent of that gap really varies, is enormously heterogeneous and varies differently for different outcomes. So you look at psychological distress, and there's some heterogeneity in the gap, but then you look at well-being and it's different. There's some countries in which boys have worse well-being as teenagers than girls. So I think even with something really, really simple, you might argue, like the gender gap, or you see so much difference when you look at it across different countries properly. The other thing coming up on a more upsetting front, I probably will be out by the time this podcast is released, is the most recent data from the UK National Millennium Cohort Study when cohort members were age 17. That data was just made available in the start of October, and we're publishing the first report around the prevalences of mental health difficulties and very high levels of difficulties, of quite serious mental health difficulties. So not only serious psychological distress, but also self-harm and attempted suicide. And I think the findings really remind us that we're very far away from not only understanding, but also being able to do and prevent mental health difficulties in adolescents. And I think this is leading to research where I think we need to think of solutions that are larger scale. So we tend to focus in mental health research on adjusting small things, whether it's adjusting individual habits or providing coping mechanisms or adjusting the direct environment. And all of these things are probably helpful. But I think the scale at which mental health difficulties are getting worse, we need to think about sort of big picture solutions and think about what a good childhood might look like and whether we're doing the things that help us get there.
Notice from your website that you are both a scientist and an artist. So I'm curious about whether these two sides intersect.
Yes, I am a scientist and an artist. So I paint. That's my sort of original art form. So I've been painting since I was a child. But more recently, when I was a PhD student, I trained to be a silversmith or a goldsmith. So I'm a jeweler. So I also make things. So I sort of make things with metal, but I also do pottery. I upcycle clothes, so I stitch. And sometimes my science and art intersect, sometimes in very small ways. So for example, I sometimes make jewelry inspired from my statistical models. More recently, I think they also intersect in trying to think about communicating complex scientific findings. Often we do really good research and it stays in scientific journals. Part of this is because there's a little bit of translation work we would need to do to make it more accessible to a wider audience, whether this is policymakers, wider public, or other stakeholders. And I think I'm trying to now more recently use my creative side to also think about sort of visually appealing, but still accurate and good ways of communicating complex scientific findings.
Finally, Belita, what is your takeaway message for those listening to our conversation?
I probably don't have to highlight to this audience that young people's mental health is a public health challenge we need to take more seriously. I'd probably end on saying, think about context, whether it is cultural or social, in which the young person is situated, and use evidence from the relevant context to inform whether it's policy interventions or support. And mental health is health, and mental health is not just mental illness, but also good mental health. So although we need to focus on reducing serious mental health difficulties, let's also think about well-being and flourishing and how we also have a society in which we can have better well-being.
Ravita, thank you ever so much. For more details on Dr. Ravita Patale, please visit the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and Twitter @ACAM. ACAMH is spelled A-C-A-M-H. And don't forget to follow us on iTunes or your preferred streaming platform. Let us know if you enjoyed the podcast with a rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAMH for short.